the Chicago influence waned after the war. Before the war, Chicago was the major center of sociology in the States. Mm. From I would say 1945, 46 on, Columbia and Chicago and Columbia and Harvard became the central places, so that all you Europeans were propagandized by Parsons and by Lazarsfeld, and you came to Harvard and you came to Yale and took that back with you. Mm-hmm. So you became functionalists and survey people, you and the Swedes, and Norway, and even in Israel, mm-hmm. in places like that. And Chicago and the qualitative style went on, but it was less visible than all the quantitative. The quantitative stuff took over sociology largely, but the qualitative research still went on. But people like, oh, I had to have a certain faith that we were doing work that would last. So we went on doing it. And people like Becker and Goffman and so on, they just did their thing. They weren't too concerned. And then in the early 70s, this stuff began to become rediscovered, primarily through Goffman and Becker's work on deviancy, which was very important here and very important in England.
Yeah. And has it to do with the students' movement?
In 1968, there was this terrific student movement in the United States, an antagonism to capitalism and universities, defense department arrangements, and that kind of thing. And in sociology, we had neo-Marxism, and suddenly interactionism became this rediscovered. And ethnomethodology came up, and a little bit of phenomenology, mm-hmm. not too much, yeah. but some of it. And suddenly the interactionists became more popular.
Yeah. In Germany, the first book what was translated in this direction was the Sikora book on measurement, his critics on measurement
yes.
in psychology. That but was translated by exponents of the students' movement.
Yes. And people like Fritz Schitzer were bringing people like Howard Garfinkel and other people to Germany.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Now, I went to England in 1972. I was there in 1970 in Cambridge, and then I went to Manchester in 1972. And I remember that in 1970, Sicarel was there, and he's a great missionary. And he went all around the country talking about ethnomethodology. And I went around and talked about things like grounded theory or whatever. And he's the one I think had the major influence, because he's very, it was important to him. And but in 1970 in England, they had discovered the deviancy stuff. So they had discovered Becker.
Yeah.
Then they discovered me. And of course, they discovered Goffman. They didn't even know about Hughes yet. So it was a very slow kind of, and they didn't know about Blumer at all.
Goffman is very popular in Germany, too.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Mm. Sure.
You have worked together with him here in San Francisco?
I knew him very well. We were good friends. No, we never worked. And his style was very different than mine.
Yeah, he always quotes San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Right. And lots of other things. In fact, when he first started, if you look at the early books, he's quoting his friends in Chicago. The students, then of course it fades out as he discovers other people. But anyway, that's how that first book got published. We decided we would write this book because we had something to say.
And we knew it was different.
We knew it was different. Now, the important thing about that book, which is still not understood by most people, is that it really had three different themes in it. Three different purposes, I guess. One was we were trying to legitimate qualitative research mm-hmm. in a period where it wasn't yet legitimated.
Yeah.
In many departments, still, it still isn't here. And that's the way it was used. And we knew that graduate students would use it on their thesis advisors and on their committees, and they did. So it became famous for that reason. And the second reason that we did it is we wanted to attack people like Blau and Parsons and Merton, because their theories were being taken over by students and younger sociologists. And just, you know, they weren't challenging the theories, they were just working them out. As we would say in American language, they were dotting I's and crossing T's on these theories. So we attacked so-called received theory.
Mm.
And that was effective. And that's why the book has this active, harsh grammar in it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when we sent the book, the draft, to the publisher, he gave it to his best editor. And the editor took all the active verbs and made them passive.
Oh.
In the first chapter, and then they sent it back, what did we think? And we screeched over the telephone, you can't do this. Oh, those active verbs are there because we're attacking. So they put them back. And then the third reason for writing the book is we wanted to put forward the idea of doing theory that was grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at least 10 years before this got picked up, because at least in America, they weren't ready yet to talk about theory.
Mm.
And many people now don't even believe in it, if they're postmodern, some of them. And some people don't believe in, you know, they do theory, but they don't believe in making it systematic. But so the book has all these elements in it. Then the next step was that we started to teach this to our students.
Mm. For me, let me tell you...
Oh, please interrupt at any point.
I read the book and I was very enthusiastic, but I didn't learn how to do grounded theory from that book. It is programmatic.
That's my next step, you see.
Yeah.
Of course it was programmatic.
It is programmatic, and then the book on theoretical sensitivity came out, which helped a bit more.
Yeah.
But I find it a bit... it's too... it's not the style I like. It's too we say hair splitting.
In the first place, he was still carrying on battles 10 years later, which he need not have done. In the second place, there are no examples in it, and I edited the book because, you know, we're still good friends. And I said to him, "Bony, put some examples in." He said, "No, let them read the monographs." But you can't talk about procedure.
We can continue.
Yeah, I was saying, there's some very good things in that book. The chapter on timing,
yeah,
personal timing. I tell the students always to read it. Now we set up this seminar,
mm-hmm.
and Barney taught that between 1968, when we had our first students, until about 1979. When I began to teach it, and I've been teaching it ever since. And the reason he wrote the book was that we decided that it would be a good thing to write a book about it. We didn't know until earlier whether you could ever write this stuff, because, you know, it's like laboratory work. We thought people would have to come and just do it with us.
Yeah.
It was, and we just didn't know how successful it would be. But anyway, he wrote the book. And then I started to teach. And then I published the next book in 1987, was it, or 88? 87 or 88. What happened is that the students began to record what went on the seminar.
Yeah.
And I said, sure, record. Because they would say, well, it goes by so fast that we would like to hear it later. And so they started to record it. And then they started to make transcriptions.
Ah,
and I started to read the transcriptions.
So many transcriptions within the book.
Yeah, and I said, my God, that's really interesting. And I said to the students, you think it would be a good idea to have a book? And they said, yes. So I started out with the idea of transcriptions, and then I developed it and kept adding things to it, and that became the book. But so my idea was to give some of the guidelines that we were using.
Yeah, it's very vivid.
That's right.
One gets the taste of the work by those transcriptions within the book.
I tell my students the last book is a pedagogical tool.
Mm-hmm.
Take you through steps, but you get a much better sense of what it is like.
Yeah.
If you look at the other book. Because it has these examples of memos and examples of codes and
That's true.
So now, what is awful is that people still go on citing the 1967 book and haven't discovered some of the later ones.
Mm-hmm.
It's just ridiculous because there are no methods in it. There are no procedures. So as you say, it's programmatic. It's not.
Mm.
It's useful, but not for knowing how to do it.
It did not help me to do my own
that's right.
grounded theory
that's
work,
right.
and it, I learned that from the later book, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the basics book is the best seller of that whole series by Sage, they tell me. And it sells widely to people, not just in sociology, which is our field, but psychology, I guess clinical psychology largely, and education, public health, nursing, and all the rest. And I know why. It's because it's a practical way of handling issues which are real to practitioners.
Yeah.
Whereas in my field, so many of the sociologists are either mainline quantitative researchers, or they're qualitative people who do ethnography.
Yeah.
Or now many of them are postmodern, so theory doesn't talk to them.
Mm.
So maybe it doesn't do as well among sociologists, but there's still many I know who do use it.
Yeah.
I don't know how many social psychologists use it. When I go to this conference in
Germany, it's widespread.
It is.
Grounded theory now is very widespread.
Among the psychologists.
Yeah, in psychology.
Yeah.
Well, the mainstream psychology, of course, is experimental and statistically oriented.
Sure.
But as soon as they are working with qualitative research methods, grounded theory, there are so many methods in qualitative research,
right, but they're all narrow.
But the grounded theory is the only, for my consideration, the only one which has proven the test of practical application.
Yeah.
And I would be interested in the development your ideas have been made within the years you have practiced grounded theory. Maybe changements, maybe different emphasis, or...
Well, the basic things that are basic to this... See, this is a methodology. It's not just a set of methods or a set of techniques.
It's a methodology and a philosophy, I think.
It's both. And my view of it is that I developed the style in some rudimentary way,
mm-hmm.
being an interactionist and using, for the most part, field research.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we discovered, of course, that it could be used on any kind of data, whether it's documentary or video or whatever. And over the years, the students have done all kinds of research, not only on different kinds of data, but on all kinds of subjects.
Mm.
Now, in my department, many of the theses are on medical health things, but not totally. So they've used it on all kinds of things. And then, in terms of my own research, I haven't just done medical things. In fact, my emphasis really is more on work than it is on medicine. Medicine is just a convenient place to do these kinds of studies.
Yeah.
But I've used it on all kinds of data.
Yeah, but you are known in Germany mostly for your studies on medical sociology.
Yes, of course.
And,
and I probably
now the last one, your work with Juliet Corbin on unending work and care.
I know that's
been
translated, yes.
And so you are known as a in the field of public health and
sure.
as a medical sociologist.
And I probably am here also. Although, you know, in Germany, Habermas had Mirrors and Mess translated very early.
Yeah.
But 1962, I think.
Yeah, yeah. He was interested in that kind
of. And they tell me that all three generations of people have read it, and of course they're all different people. But I know that I'm known for the medical stuff, and now for the method.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, let us first maybe continue about ground theory.
Yeah.
Your ideas now, even maybe difficulties you see, problems within the method.
Well, things which are central to what I do. And we really laid it out this way in the original book. The things that I do that are central are the coding is theoretical. It's not just classification.
Mm-hmm.
I recently had an email correspondence with a man who's a young sociologist in Finland, and he had gone to some computer conferences, and they were all talking about ground theory, and so. These are social scientists, computer people. And so he wrote this article on grounded theory in computers, and he sent it to me through the email. And I pointed out to him, his point was correct, which is that these computer people are drawn to grounded theory because the coding is something they can translate into computer language.
Mm.
But I said classification is not coding.
Yeah.
Coding is what you do with the classifications, all the dimensions and the properties of, and the relationships. And so one of the central things is this drive toward theorizing.
Mm.
And another is the theoretical sampling.
Yeah.
And I came to that very early, even though I didn't have the word for it. And I don't remember whether Bonnie thought of it or I did. It doesn't make a difference. We don't even remember anymore. But I used to see people at Chicago and elsewhere. They'd have these piles of interviews and field data. And they would get it, and then they would wonder, what do you do with this? And I realized early, you know, you have an interview and you begin to think about it. And then you think about it some more. And then you put that into the next interview. So even before I had any notions of that grand theory, I was moving to this theoretical sampling business. And then the third element is the comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have those three, you've got the methodology. But then people do it differently depending on the different kinds of materials they've got. If you're doing historical work,
mm-hmm.
you still do those things, but you have to use specific techniques to get it what you want, and you'll adapt the style to that. Like I have, you'll meet a student, somebody tomorrow, when she comes, who did a thesis on reproductive biology, and she did field work in laboratories. She read all the materials that were documentary, including the records at laboratories, and she did historical work on these documents. And so, you know, but she used ground theory, but she had to adapt it to the particular kinds of you know, situation. So I see the style being very varied over time as people work on different kinds of material and so on. And your point about can you use a shortened version of some sort to do policy research is exactly the kind of thing I mean. If you have an issue like that, the question is, what is there about this methodology that's adaptable to what you're doing? I don't want to be a purist about it.
Mm.
I mean, I want it to be useful. Then there are people, I'm sure, who want to combine it with quantitative research. They can do that, that's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, why not?
You are a pragmatist.
At what point would you have the feeling, oh no, that's no more my theory, that's no longer
the woman whose husband invented the computer program called Nudist. Do you know Nudist?
Yeah, in Australia.
Lynn Richards at a conference asked me, how far out can it go before you don't call it grounded theory? I thought that was a very good question, and I thought a minute about it, a couple of moments. And I said, if they do these things, it's grounded theory. If they don't, it's something, then they've done something else, or maybe some parts of it. But they have to do the comparisons, they have to do the theoretical sampling of some kind, and they have to do whatever the third and whatever
the
third.
The coding,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
If they're not writing theory. Like, for example, many of the nurses picked up Barney's book on theoretical sensitivity, and they write these things they call grounded theory that have to do with a basic process, because he emphasizes this. Not the only thing he emphasizes, but as you know, but they pick this up, so they have these sequences, and they write sequences, but they don't do any analysis of it, really.
Mm-hmm.
There are no inner comparisons or anything. So somebody sent me a paper by a nurse. I said I would read it, though I don't usually. And she does exactly that. You know, she doesn't claim grounded theory, but she has these sequences, but she doesn't do anything with it. So what I told Lynn was, if they do that, I call it grounded theory. If not, it's, even though they call it grounded theory, it's not mine.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I can't stop it. I mean, who can stop those kinds of intellectual movements?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm a practitioner. I mean, I probably never would have even written about methodology if I hadn't stumbled onto it. And if Barney hadn't been around, maybe I wouldn't have done it. See, for my generation, methodology was quantitative stuff, and a methodologist was some guy they would call in to say, how do I design this project? That was a methodologist to me. And that wasn't my qualitative tradition at all.
Yeah.
So.
Within your book, you quote Mills with his article on Theron Mills with his article on intellectual craftsmanship.
Oh yes. Yeah.
And I think it has. He doesn't call it like that, but it has a lot to do with grounded theory too.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, there are similarities.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you what I learned from Mills. I read Mills early and I liked him, although I recognize, you know, there are two sides to Mills. He was a pragmatist from the pragmatist movement, not a pragmatist in practice, but he came out of Dewey and Mead and people like that. But he also came out of American populism. Veblen, a student of Veblen.
Yeah.
And so he's a social critic. And these two things come together, and you can feel that these two things are in his writing that don't quite come together in the research that he did, even though it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But primarily the social criticism runs away with what he actually did.
Mm.
But he's an interesting man.
Yeah.